Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business. Take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
And welcome back to another episode of Wings for Breakfast, our twice weekly Red Wings podcast here on The Athletic. I'm Max Boltman. With me as always is Prashant Iyer. And we've kind of missed a lot here over this last period since we last recorded. The Red Wings have had three games. They won one. They lost once in overtime to Chicago last night. And they also, I think, lost one to Nashville. I don't think we had covered that game yet. So a full series and a half that we have to catch up on here. We will certainly do that. But overall, Prashant, I mean, the theme that's been emerging right now for the Red Wings is they have seemed to find a little bit of their stride here. And even though they're still not really getting the wins regularly, they're playing much better hockey than they were earlier this year.
Yeah, I think you have to be somewhat encouraged by how the process at least looks. You know, Jeff Blashill likes to talk about the process and that if you continue to play in a certain fashion over time, you're going to get those victories kind of trending your direction. And I think the Red Wings have certainly done that in the second half of the season thus far. I mean, their first eight games, pretty brutal. But to be fair, they had a pretty tough first eight games. You had Carolina twice. You had Columbus, a team that's always been difficult for them, twice. And then you had Dallas twice in there. I mean, you're talking about an Eastern Conference finalist and then, the Western Conference champion last year. So those are, you know, certainly tough opponents. But since they've been able to, move past that and get into their stretch where they've had a lot of Florida, Nashville, another round of Chicago, a couple games against Tampa, I think they've certainly looked a hell of a lot better on the ice. I don't know what you would think there, Max.
I thought they've looked better, too. And I actually thought, you know, they to me, looked like they were in control for most of that Chicago game yesterday. And obviously, they go down 2-0 at the start. But especially as it got late in the game there, once they had tied it up, you know, I really felt like they were really on the cusp of a couple goals on a couple different occasions late in that game. Anthony Mantha came very close to a really nice rush goal. Dylan Larkin almost banks one off of Subban's back. Or actually takes one off of Subban's back and puts it in the net late in the game. He doesn't quite go in, and the Red Wings obviously go to overtime and lose. But also, you know, that Nashville series, you know, Nashville, I think it's important to say, has not looked good at all this year, and they look like they may be in the beginning stages of a rebuild where they need to tear down, and we may cover that a little bit later on this show. So, you know, you take the opponents with a little bit of context, but, you know, Florida also just went toe-to-toe with Tampa over the weekend, and that's a team the Red Wings have been even with in every one of their games with them so far. And so I do think it's a sign of a process that seems to be working. I mean, a couple of different Red Wings have talked about they had the proverbial players meeting after their embarrassing loss to Tampa a few series back now, and really since that time and that meeting, I've had a hard time finding major faults with their 5-on-5 game. obviously, I don't think the power play is still scored. Then they're at like 0-for-20-something at this point, or for their last 20-something at this point. That's still obviously a very major fault. But beyond that, you know, I'm having a hard time finding major quibbles with the game, especially because last night they were generating their suppressing their usual amount of chances, but also generating a pretty healthy number of them.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the stats for the Wings over the last 9 games or so, their expected goals for percentage at 5-on-5 is 55%. Like that's up towards where the top 10 teams, top 8 teams in the league usually sit if you're running a stretch like that. Now, granted, those teams do it over the course of a season, not just a nine game stretch. But I mean, just go across the board at the stats. At 5-on-5, Detroit's outscoring their opponents by 3 goals over the last 9 games, 17-14. They're out shooting them by plus 20 shots. And you've got a 5-on-5 expected goals for percentage of 55%. And so the frustrating part is you walk out of that and you won 2 of those games. That's it. And so I think as a Detroit, you know, fan, member of the organization, you and I, you have to watch it and just go, man, it's really frustrating because they've looked pretty good for the most part, but just simply aren't getting the rewards. And, you know, to your point, Max, where it's coming down to right now is they're losing these games in really the extra 10 minutes that are not played at 5-on-5. I mean, their power play right now hasn't scored in the last 49 minutes. You know, the fascinating stat that I've got for you is their 5-on-5 goals for per 60 is 1.9. Their 5-on-4 goals for per 60 is 1.9. They are scoring the exact same amount with one extra guy on the ice that they are at 5-on-5 right now.
Oh, my God.
You are literally losing these games because you can't score on the power play. So I think that's where you have to step back, be happy about how well they've turned around their 5-on-5 play, but also be incredibly frustrated that the margin for them right now is simply you need to find a way to score with an extra guy on the ice.
You know, I honestly am even a little shocked that it's up at 1.9. I mean, I guess that just the sheer number of minutes has to dictate a healthy percentage of that, but whew, they're all for, is it 25 by now? 26?
I think it's 25 like or 26 power plays. I haven't been tracking the exact number of power play chances. I usually like to track minutes since some power plays can end prematurely or some may run up against the end of a third period or whatnot. So you're right now sitting at about 49 minutes, which works out to roughly 25 full power plays that you have not scored on in a row. Surprisingly, that's not the longest streak the Wings have gone on in the last 15 years, but it is certainly very, very noteworthy right now when they are controlling games as much as they are at 5-on-5.
Just to give, I know not all of our audience loves like number heavy stuff and number heavy analysis. So I'm just going to contextualize this because I think, you know, like that stat is truly astonishing. So what Prashant basically just said is if the Red Wings played the entire game at 5-on-5 and there was no special teams, you'd expect them to score about 2 goals. And that holds up with exactly what we've seen all year. That's literally what they do. They score 1 or 2 goals at 5-on-5 just about every game. Sometimes they'll pop for 3. One time they popped for 4. But for the most part, they score 2 goals just about every game. What he's saying is that even if you reduce that to they played the entire game at 5-on-4, they'd still just score 2 goals, maybe a little less. Like, that is mind-blowing.
It's just, it's fascinating. If you don't believe me, because please go and double-check this, go to Evolving Hockey, pull it up, go to the team tables, and look at 5-on-5, no adjustment, what the goals for per 60 is. It's 1.92. And then switch it to 5-on-4, and it's 1.9. They are legitimately scoring the exact same amount of goals when they have an extra guy on the ice. And that's inexcusable because really, if you think about it, you know, less than 20% of the hockey game is played on special teams. They are losing these games in the 20% margin, not in the 80% part. They're doing great in the 80% part of late. They just have to find a way to score some goals and stop some when they're shorthanded, which was at least something they were able to accomplish against Chicago.
And did you say it's expected goals or actual goals?
These are actual goals.
Actual goals.
1.92 versus 1.9.
Because sometimes coaches will tell you that like the public data on expected goals does not match their internal modeling. But you know, goals are goals.
These are goals. There is no expected goals shenanigans here. I swear to you, this is exactly the same number.
That's crazy. You also had a number last night that you threw out about expected goals that when I saw it, I was like, okay, that sounds like an exaggeration, but I went and checked it and I didn't do the tabulation, but it definitely, you mentioned that the Red Wings were averaging about 55% expected goals, 4% over their last 9 games. And I was like, that can't be it. But you know, here you go. Last 9 games, 65%, 48%, 44, 56, 52, 62, 32. That was the bad Lightning game. 47, 63, you know, there's some ups and downs there, but that works out pretty close.
It works out to 54.8%. So go ahead and double check that. It's again, it's right there. And so you just have to stop yourself and say, how did you walk away with only 2 wins out of these 9 games? It's because you couldn't score on the power play and you couldn't stop the other team's power play. You're losing in the margins right now, which again, maybe is encouraging, but at the same time is incredibly frustrating.
Well, and you can tell the frustration from all comers right now, because after every single game, I don't think there's been a game in at least a week, probably 2 weeks, where we haven't asked Jeff Blashill and whichever player they bring out for us about the power play. I can absolutely tell they're sick of talking about it. I can tell from the fan base that they are sick of hearing about it, because, you know, in a lot of ways, it's like if you and I keep coming on here and say, and frankly, if the players and coaches, as they have been, keep saying like they think that, you know, that they're, whether it's they're close or whether they're going to look at it and try to do something different, you know, we've heard different variations of that. And that frankly reflects the different performances. They've had some games they looked like they probably should have scored on the power play and just didn't. They've had some games where they couldn't enter the zone on the power play. And then you and I come on here and we say, yeah, but if they get the power play figured out, they're going to start getting results. And I think people hear it and they go, okay, so what's the holdup? Like, you know what the problem is, like, just do it. And, you know, I think it is a little more complicated than that, but at the same time, it's also kind of, you know, I don't think the fix is simple, but the problem is staring you right in the eye there.
Yeah. I mean, this is the biggest, most glaring problem that's standing right over you and trying to hit you upside the head with a jackhammer. And it's got to be so frustrating for them. I thought they were turning the corner. If you go back, you know, the second Florida game, you know, the February 9th game, they looked pretty solid. You know, then they looked okay in the 2 games against Nashville. I thought they were able to generate some chances. And then you go to the Chicago game. They had 2 power plays, 4 full minutes on the power play. They managed 1 shot on goal and they actually gave up a shot against. So you end up with a basically net neutral standpoint here. You manage 0.02 expected goals for, meaning the shot you attempted wasn't even that good anyways. So there's got to be something that has to be done. And obviously, you know, you and I can speculate all you want. We've talked about handedness. We've done a power play redux here. You know, I've thrown a whole video thread out on Twitter. It's obviously not as simple as you and I are making it seem to be, but until that gets fixed, until there is a big change to that, it's just going to continue to be the focus, because that is the sole reason. I shouldn't say sole, because I think there's a couple other things that go in there, but that is the major reason right now the Wings are not winning more of these games.
One of the mailbag questions for today is about that, and it's basically, let me find it. We'll just we're not going to do the whole mailbag right now, but since we're on this topic, I thought, you know, we might as well. Okay, it's from Marcus Gwynn Newman, and he says, it seems the Red Wings power play is the main thing holding him back from winning games. How much of the blame lies with Bylsma, and what does it take for an assistant coach to be removed? You know, we've kind of done this whole coaching conversation. I think this is a very relevant thing, because it is true that the power play is Dan Bylsma's responsibility, but what this comes down to basically is the question is the problem that the Red Wings have a scheme that is just completely ill-fated and has no chance to work, and that could go to their in-zone setup, which is virtually identical to most of the league. It could go to kind of some philosophical stuff. It could go to or it could go to like entering the zone. You know, I think that's a real legitimate question: is are the Red Wings entering the zone well? But it also comes back to personnel. I mean, the thing that gets the most heat in my mentions, at least, about the Red Wings power play is the drop pass entry. And I get it, because the Red Wings aren't that good at it. But, you know, I also watch teams do it all throughout the league and they enter the zone. So I don't think the drop pass is the problem. There's clearly something else about the entry that's not working. And I don't know that I can see what it is. Like, that's kind of the reality of it. It's a limitation because, you know, I certainly would love to be able to tell you this is what's going wrong. But all I can do is theorize about like, okay, well, on this time it was, you know, this was the issue. But, you know, it is this really delicate balance of like, you know, I can't say that I think this scheme is like effective and is just like an inch from working because it hasn't looked close. But at the same time, I don't know how much of that falls on the players, how much of that falls on the execution. There's certainly a balance. It's not all on the players, but I don't know if it's – I don't know how to find that balance. Do you have any insight there?
Yeah. I mean, the power play discussion is just so fascinating because it is important to note that changes have been made. Like system decision-making things have been implemented mid-season here as you're watching. So if you go back and you watch kind of the first six or seven games, the drop pass was almost the exclusive zone entry play for the Red Wings. They've kind of shifted more recently almost to a center cut entry where you've got a guy who starts on the opposition's blue line. And as the defenseman kind of rushes the puck up the ice, he starts to creep towards the middle, creates a lane on the backside for, you know, the guy who's the potential drop pass recipient to cut up if he needs to. You get a little bit of extra motion there. I think the Wings have had a little bit more success with that. You know, you're absolutely right, Max, that the drop pass, other teams do it very successfully. I mean, there's plenty of work out there. I've done work on it. I think there's articles on The Athletic from me doing long video analysis of the drop pass. You can go back and find work from Eric Parnas, who's a analyst for the Colorado Avalanche. His whole special teams project, he devoted an entire series to that. Bottom line, teams are successful at doing it. I think there's an article I wrote sometime maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I don't even remember anymore at this point, comparing the differences in drop pass styles between having a single guy back for drop pass versus having two guys back on the drop pass, which is actually what Jim Hiller used to do with the power play back in 2014, 2015, when the Wings were the best power play in the league. And that was kind of another option. But I think importantly, the moral of what I'm getting at is changes have been made. System changes have been made. So now the challenge comes down to, is it a lack of execution of a system that we see that works on other teams with other players? And is this simply the skill's not there, the decision-making's not there in the moment by the players? Or are there further optimization schemes that can be done, you know, from Dan Bylsma, from Jeff Blashill, to put the players in better situations? I think that was certainly a valid critique early in the season when we saw a lot of perimeter passing. We saw, you know, no real passing lanes available because of lack of handedness. Now, again, granted, you were missing your entire second unit there, but there was a lot of issues with the way that was set up. More recently, they've made changes to the entry plans. They've made changes to the end zone scheme. You're seeing a lot more use of the slot. You're seeing a lot more of a crash the net approach. But you're also still missing the guy who scored the most power play goals for your team in Tyler Bertuzzi. So I don't know. That's kind of where I'm going to leave you is I think there's valid critiques that there's maybe more system optimization that can be done, although a lot has been done already in the season. And then I think the rest of it, you kind of have to say that the decision-making from the players maybe isn't where it needs to be. And that's why you don't see the same success that you do with other teams running the exact same play.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And, you know, like you watch like Chicago would be a pretty good example of a team that, you know, they have a guy like Patrick Kane, who I think can make a lot of this happen. Just because you have to be so aware of Patrick Kane, no matter what he's doing, he's going different spots in the offensive zone. You see him, you know, on his kind of spot on the flank, but you'll also see him come up a little higher when he needs to. And, you know, you do hear, you know, I think some calls for more movement on the Red Wings power play. And I do think there's something to that. I think, you know, especially when one of your big weapons is Anthony Mantha's one-timer, if teams are able to kind of pack it in and just get enough shins in the way, at some point it gets really hard for Mantha to get that thing to where it needs to be. Now, what does that movement look like though? Like, that's a very fair question. Like, you don't want just Dylan Larkin circling the zone and letting the rest of your team play 4-on-4 or something like that. You don't want too much crossing over happening to the point that, guys aren't where they need to be, but you do basically want something to happen where at some point some member of the penalty kill has to leave their little box that they sit in. And once that happens, then you open up those cross seam plays, then you open up a shooting lane, and then ultimately when you crash the net, you got a prayer at getting a rebound onto net before it just gets simply cleared away. I think that's a big issue, and to me, I think the entries and frankly face off sometimes, some nights, it depends. But just in terms of getting possession in the offensive zone would solve at least half of this. Like, I think if you get set up more, then screw it. Philip Zadina and Anthony Mantha and Tyler Bertuzzi and Dylan Larkin are good enough hockey players that they are going to score goals with enough time in the offensive zone together. I do think there was some kind of forcing the one Mantha one timer going on too much early in the year. But broadly speaking, get set up enough times and you're going to get enough chances that they will equate to goals. And I think that if I was going to put one thing above all the others, it's that just get in the zone and get set up. But if you ask me to tell you how to do it, I don't know. And that's why I don't want to lie to anybody and give them this false idea that it's this one quick fix. I don't know that it is. It could be. But I have a hunch that if it was, they'd have done it by now, because I promise you they're as mad and sick of hearing about it as anybody out there.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree. I don't think it's a quick fix. I think there's a lot of different things that you and I can throw out. I don't think either of us, I'll speak for both of us here, Max, have the same knowledge as the guys actually coaching this. But that being said, it's tough. It's not an easy fix. There's a lot of different things to consider here, but I do think at the end of the day, the Red Wings have the personnel to do this. They just need to continue to go back to the drawing board, continue to reevaluate, continue tinkering, and don't settle for what they've got right now and just hope it gets better, because right now what they're getting is very different than what we're seeing at 5-on-5, where at least they're playing really well and not getting results. I don't think the same can be said of the power play.
Yep. I think that's right. All right. We don't have to spend a ton of time, especially on the Nashville series, because, you know, it's been a while now, but what stood out to you about it? Obviously you get the game in there that, may best exemplify what the Red Wings want to do, and that being game two against Nashville. Game two, or was that game one?
The second game was the 4-2 win, yep.
Right, so it's a 4-2 win, and really it kind of looked more like a 4-1 win based on the flow of play. Nashville gets one late, but it exemplifies exactly what the Red Wings want to do. Not all the goals are pretty goals. Adam Ernie and Luke Lindenning both scored what I would call cheap goals, but, you know, they weren't kind of cheap for them to get there. Adam Ernie has to stick handle through traffic. Luke Lindenning has to be possessing the puck and get it into a shot where something like that has to have a prayer going in. I don't think most goalies are gonna let either of those goals in more than 1-2% of the time. But you get enough chances like that, you get yourself into the position to take advantage of those breaks when they happen. And every once in a while, you'll get two in the same game. And the rest of it, I thought, was great. Anthony Mantha, that was his laser snipe game. I forget how the first goal happened, but nevertheless, the Red Wings were heavy on the forecheck. They controlled possession for a lot of the night. And I even though I don't think their expected goals number ended up being crazy,
it was like 53.8%.
Yeah, it wasn't crazy, but they were in control.
Yeah, I mean, that was a really good game from start to finish, you know, from the Wings. I do think they had a little lapse there where in the third, where Nashville was kind of able to counter a little bit. But I mean, honestly, that was a great game from the fourth line. I mean, you're right. I think really the only goalie who tends to give up those kinds of goals is Pekka Rinne. I mean, that Adam Ernie goal was kind of close to an amateur version of a Datsyuk goal that he scored against Rinne years ago. Very similar move. You know, Rinne tends to play a lot with his upper body and tends to want to move his upper body in the direction of the shot as opposed to being positioned, you know, prior to it. And that's why you see goals like what Ernie scored, what Glendening scored. Those aren't shots that usually go in. I think the Fabry goal, that was a great play by Filppula behind the net.
That's right. Fabry
to center that to Fabry in front. Obviously Rinne doesn't have a chance on that one, but you know, that's the kind of game Detroit's got to play. They really limited Nashville's opportunity to do anything. They had a couple of guys outside Larkin and Mantha chip in, Glendening in a big way. I mean, prior to that game, he hadn't had a point in 42 games.
He gets three.
And then for Adam Ernie, he hadn't scored a goal in 36 games, and he gets a goal there. So it's like, you got secondary scoring that you don't really get, really tertiary scoring in Detroit's case. And so that's the kind of game that if they can get those bounces, continue to, exert their system on other teams, that's the wins that they're hoping turn their direction. However, it would be a lot easier if that power play just scored a couple goals.
Yeah, I was just going to say, crucially, they actually carried it over. Like, it was not one of these like flash in the pan games of every once in a while, this is going to work. They put it right back on the ice against Chicago 2 days later. This is Monday night. And it looked good. Like, it looked like, oh, you know, as I'm watching it, even as they were trailing, I was thinking, man, they are outplaying Chicago. They tie the game. And I kind of, with Patrick Kane on the ice, I think I did predict to Larry Lage of the AP that Kane would score the game winner late or an OT. I was not correct about that, but you do always think like that's when he tends to pop up. But I thought the Red Wings earned that win. And when Anthony Mantha got his late breakaway, I thought, oh, this might be it.
I was really, really pulling him. In fact, that was probably one of the games I've been more invested in over the year because of how well, Detroit played at 5-on-5. I mean, that was a great game for them to pull out. And it's kind of disappointing that it ends on a sour note, which I think left a lot of people frustrated. You have the 3-on-1 that doesn't go your way. You have the play where a lot of people are lamenting Zadina not shooting. I think it was a totally reasonable play to pass back and try and set things up there. However, the play ends up not working. And then Philip Perona kind of late in the shift makes a little aggressive pinch that ultimately backfires. And so definitely leaves a sour taste. But I think it's real important to step back, look at the big picture. This is a team that's playing well right now, in spite of not getting the results they want. They're still missing the guy who was arguably the best player for them over the first 10 games or so. Continue to sustain this momentum, and I think you'll see some good things happen for the Red Wings.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
All right. So what you just said, I think, is a perfect lead in to our main topic for today, which is also based on one of your tweets from last night. You had a great night on Twitter last night, buddy.
I mean, it was much needed because I was getting real tired of everyone getting so mad at the team. It was like, all right, we're going to start firing off some stuff here.
You were very good on Twitter last night, and what I thought struck the chord with me is you had a tweet about, and we might just call the episode the five stages of an NHL rebuild, because you hit this so hard on the head with how this goes and the cycles that it goes on, and in particular how the cycles aren't the same length. Like, it's not 2 years stage one, 2 years stage two, 2 years stage three, whatever. So why don't you introduce this concept and let's just spend like 15 minutes, 20 minutes or whatever talking about this, how it applies to the Red Wings, how it might apply to some other teams around the league.
Yeah, I mean, the tweet in its gist was, I was watching a lot of people get really frustrated at the Red Wings for blowing it in overtime. There's calls for the coaching's head, calls for the players' heads. So the tweet basically says there's five stages to a rebuild, and we've rapidly shifted into angry about playing well and still losing after experiencing the play so bad I don't want to watch phase last season and the no, they're still competitive, I promise phase prior to that. So, then I followed it up by saying I'm very much looking forward to when we have this team is definitely a playoff contender phase. And then subsequently the, no, I think you're overrating this team. They can't be a cup favorite. And so I think when you're thinking about how these line up with the stages of a rebuild and you apply them to the Red Wings, the whole we're still competitive phase is basically the crux of the Red Wings from 2013 to 2018. I think on an episode long ago, one of the things I said was the worst thing that could have happened to the Red Wings was taking Chicago to seven games in the 2013 playoffs. I think that was honestly the thing that gave them the false hope that they could be competitive. You know, that's the season after Nick Lidstrom is retired, Brian Rafalski is gone. That's your chance to start tearing down and rebuild. Instead, you know, in a shortened 48 game season, you take a juggernaut Chicago team to seven games. You were up 3-1 in the series. You just about closed them out in game six before giving up kind of a handful of goals in the third period of that game. And then you lose game seven in overtime on a ricochet off of Nick Cronwall that goes past Jimmy Howard. You know, that one really set Detroit down this path to believing they're so competitive. That's when you get the Justin Abdelkader extension. That's when you get the 2016 offseason where you give contracts to Franz Nielsen, Thomas Vanek, Steve Ott. You re-sign Glendening for 4 years, Helm for 5 years, DeKeyser for 6 years. You know, it's just...
Because why wouldn't you? You're still contending.
Right, we're still contending. We're still competitive. This is a team that is able to compete despite, you know, 2015, 2016, you scored only a 4 goals against Tampa in 5 games. You lost in 5 to them there. And you head into 2016, 2017 with really no better expectation. And then in that season, you come away with 79 points. And you're just like, wow, yeah, okay, we missed the playoffs by a fair bit here. But then you had that lead into 17, 18, where, again, they're still approaching the season as being competitive. Now, the 18 trade deadline is where I think the realization sort of hits that, okay, we're not competitive, because now you're dealing Thomas Tatar, you're dealing Peter Mrazek, you're making those moves ultimately a little too late, because then you get to 18, 19 and you still are stuck in this holding pattern. You're still making weird moves. You go out and sign Trevor Daley for 3 years. That doesn't make a lot of sense to do at that point in time. But ultimately you sort of like stagger your way into this, and then finally 19, 20 hits and now we're hearing, okay, they're really bad and I can barely
win. Well, hang on. Let's pause, because I want to go into that stage one and do a little bit of more on that. Because number one, I would argue that this is the most important stage of the rebuild. It's the most avoidable. But for the reasons that you mentioned, it's also the most understandable to be in denial about. Like you have these players, you have Datsyuk and Zetterberg, and you're saying, how can I not try to keep my playoff streak alive? How can I not try and get everything I can out of these two players that I cannot just go replace? You can have the maybe not first overall, but you could have like the second overall pick in most drafts and not find a Datsyuk or a Zetterberg. Like, and you shouldn't expect to. I mean, if you have first overall, you probably got like a 40 to 50% chance of finding one of those two guys. But if you don't, I don't know that you're finding one. Those are two outstanding players who were near the top of the NHL. Datsyuk's a no doubt Hall of Famer. In my opinion, Zetterberg should be a Hall of Famer. I don't quite know, you know, there's different considerations that go in terms of hardware that he might have a harder time getting. But I think he is a Hall of Famer, in my opinion. When you have those guys, I can forgive trying to push it in for a while. But at the same time, that's how you look back and say, oh, God, this was 2 years too late, 3 years too late. And I think that makes it a fascinating dynamic. And I think there is a very obvious team who is in this spot right now, and that's the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Yeah, I mean, that's literally the team that parallels this. I mean, you look at their moves prior to 2019-2020, and really during the season, they just don't make any sense. And they're doing the same thing Detroit did, you know, back in 2013, 14, 15, and 16. I mean, you're going out, you're still going out and getting Jason Zucker, but you're giving up a conditional first round pick in Callan Addison. Like, you're going out, you're signing Brandon Tanev for 6 years. I mean, that's a move that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You're going out and giving a first round pick to Toronto to get Kasperi Kapanen, a move that doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So, you know, you go out and you trade for Mike Matheson, who's on a really long contract. That doesn't make any sense. Like, it was move after move after move. It's easy to buy into it. It's easy to say, I have Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin, and Chris Letang. I need to do everything I can to win with them one more time, right? And what you end up doing is you mortgage your entire future to do that without realizing that there's not that high of a likelihood that you're going to pull this off. I mean, you're not taking stock of where your team is. You're not taking stock of the supporting cast, and you're hoping those elite guys can still be elite at the highest level. I mean, when we were talking about Zetterberg and Datsyuk in 2016, you're talking about a Datsyuk who is, you know, 37, 38 years old, you know, really starting to slow down. And as Henrik Zetterberg that has had a bad back injury and is trying to deal with kind of still playing through that. And even though they're demonstrating that they're still effective, they're not 2007, 2008 Henrik Zetterberg and Pavel Datsyuk that just blew away the league. They're 10 years older. They're 10 years, you know, more beaten up, and they're not going to drag you forward in the same way that you think. And so I think Pittsburgh is the classic team right now that is doing this. We actually just witnessed this a few years ago with San Jose, right? They just tried to do this with Joe Thornton and Patrick Marleau. Yes. They go out, they make a big
contract. Almost did it too.
Right. They almost did it. But now you look at where San Jose is and you go, oh, yeah. This is now San Jose is in the, oh God, they're so bad.
Carlson right. is six more years at however many million dollars.
That's exactly it. And so there's teams all around the league that still continue to make this mistake. I think you're going to see Washington make this mistake with Alex Ovechkin this offseason. So it's just going to keep happening. But in Detroit's case, it's why we are where we are right now is because the most important thing to dealing with this problem is recognizing you have the problem. Yeah. And that's, for some reason, the hardest thing for NHL GMs to figure out.
I honestly don't even know that it's complete ignorance. I think it is in some cases like a calculated, like, okay, I might have a 2% chance of doing it this year or a 4% chance of doing it this year. But once I start this rebuild, it's 8 years of hell. Honestly, not that unlikely that I lose my job halfway through this rebuild, because rebuilds are painful and fans get testy and ownership gets antsy and shit happens. And, you know, Ron Hextall got fired halfway through the Flyers rebuild and oops, it was a very good rebuild. And you fired the guy who did it halfway through because it sucks to be in that spot, right? So I can understand. I think there might even be some just kind of, this makes sense for this GM because they've got star players, and once they tear it down, like, ooh, his future gets a little dicier. Like, as long as you got Sidney Crosby and Evgeny Malkin or Chris Letang or whatever, you can really go to ownership and say, look, we can win. We got, you know, two of the best players of this generation and a very, very good, you know, defenseman here. I don't see why we shouldn't go add one more of this, and that first round pick's going to be in the 20s anyway, and this and that and whatever. And it only comes back to bite you when that first round pick's Andrei Vasilevsky and whatever. And this is what happened to the Red Wings. Like, the 19th overall pick they traded for Kyle Quincy. Oops, that's Andrei Vasilevsky. So not that the Red Wings would have necessarily taken him, and this, you can do these things all day long, but so that, I think, is the most fascinating stage of this, because it is the most understandable. It's not totally delusional, but it is the phase that when you wake up the next day, you have a hangover from hell of that one more drink, I guess, that you tried to take out of the fountain of elite talent, and you wake up the next day, and that is a harsh, harsh wake-up call. That's phase two.
Yeah. And so then phase two is, oh God, like, this is, they're really, really bad. And I can barely watch
this.
It's
going to be a
while. Right. And then you go, oh shoot. All right. Let me buckle up, because I need to prepare myself to deal with this. And that was Red Wings fans in 2019, 2020. That was the realization. Now, not every team is going to have a, oh God, it's this bad season, as bad as Detroit did last year. But the fun part about this stage is this can come in what many ways feels like it's coming out of nowhere, right? Because you look at San Jose and all of a sudden, bam, that was a team that traded the first round pick to Ottawa thinking we are going to be a playoff contending team. And that pick is a top five pick for Ottawa the very next season because they did not play everything correctly. And it's the same thing with teams dealing with Pittsburgh right now. There's just that chance that Pittsburgh straight up bottoms out. And I think that's what people continue to hope for. And you saw the same thing here with Detroit. It was a little bit more gradual. You know, you had 16, 17, 17, 18, 18, 19, all in the 73 to 79 point range. But then bam, 19, 20, bottom falls out. You had 39 points in 71 games. Wow. That got really ugly really quickly. And so then that kind of sets the stage for, okay, this is going to be a while.
18-19 falls in that, right?
I think it does.
18-19 and 19-20.
Yeah. I mean, I think 18-19 definitely falls in they're really bad because they were losing a lot of games. Now, 18-19, you may not have felt the same way because, again, in 18-19, they were among the league leaders in one-goal losses. Everything felt competitive, but they were still losing a lot of games. And then 19-20 is, oh, God, they're getting blown out every night. And, you know, this is where Ottawa is right now. This is where San Jose is right now. This is where the Kings are right now. Yeah. You know, and this is where Detroit is trying to climb out of right now. And, you know, your goal is to make this not that long of a session. You don't want this to be as long as the we're still competitive phase, which is arguably the longest phase here. You want this to be very quick and move out of it. Ottawa still hasn't figured it out. They're still stuck here. They've been stuck here for 3 years. They're hoping that Tim Stützle and, you know, Thomas Chabot and those guys are enough to get them moving forward. Brady Tkachuk. But fact of the matter is they're still stuck here. You know, their 6-5 win against the Maple Leafs notwithstanding. They haven't figured out how to climb out of this hole. Whereas I think right now, where we are right now with Detroit, they are starting to figure it out. And I think they're kind of shifting into the, this is frustrating to watch because it feels like they're so close, but they keep losing. And I think,
That's a mid-season shift.
Yeah.
Because the first two, three weeks of this, it certainly felt just like last year. I think the first four games actually accepted. The first four games, I think, you know, they go 2-2. I thought they played okay hockey for the most part. I didn't think they looked as dejected as they had last year, but they go on that, whatever it was, 6 or 7 game losing streak. And I completely agree that my brain with the fan base and what they were saying, my brain was, oh, okay, it's another last year.
Yeah.
And then something shifted after that Tampa game. Something has shifted.
Yeah. I don't know what it was, if it is that players meeting or whatnot. I mean, hell, I dragged out the worst goals differential graph because I thought I was going to need it.
That's right.
I mean,
you took it out of storage.
You know, it was sitting there in the Dropbox and I was like, all right, I guess we're going to have to pull this code back out because I'm not expecting to use it this year. But here we are again. In fact, their goal differential was worse than last year's team through the first 8 games or so. But then all of a sudden the switch is flipped. And now you're kind of sitting here going, man, this is really frustrating to watch because it feels like they should be winning these games, but they're still somehow losing these games. And I think this kind of phase and the next phase that we'll talk about after this are the most dangerous phases for a team, because this is where you can get overconfident in what you've already accomplished and you can start taking steps that don't fit.
Or just tired of right. what you haven't done.
Yes.
Like you just might get tired of like, I can't stand this anymore. I want to do something drastic. I want to trade my best player because I can't stand it.
Or you go out and you make a big free agent splash because you're right. like, I have to do something. Yes. I have to do something different. And that's the scary part here, because in this phase and the next phase, if you do those things at the wrong time and everything doesn't line up, you're going backwards. You're not going to continue going forwards. And this is what we've seen a team like Edmonton too, right? You go out, you get Connor McDavid. You're like, all right, you know, I'm feeling good, but I'm going to trade Taylor Hall for Adam Larson. And then I'm going to, you know, go out and sign Milan Lucic for 6 years because these are moves that I think are moving me forward when they're moving you backwards. They're not letting you go in that direction. And that's how Edmonton, you know, is still stuck in this kind of purgatory. I think Vancouver's another team that we can throw in there with some of the bizarre moves they've made.
Tyler Myers.
Right. The Tyler Myers deal doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I don't know why you did that. You know, that's just a move that doesn't make sense. And had you played that correctly and bided your time, and now you have Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson, like, you could have been in a better spot, but you got impatient. And so that's the key here for the Red Wings, is stick this out. You got to be like Carolina. Carolina stuck it out for a while. They were in purgatory. They went 10 years between playoff appearances. Although you can kind of argue they didn't really start to rebuild until about 2014 in the correct sense. So they really went 4 years from kind of that start point to playoffs, and really playoffs to conference finals in the same season. That's what you're hoping for, is that kind of turnaround. But if you jump too quick or you make the wrong move, you're in trouble.
You're dead on, because Vancouver went from this place where they get this huge coup. What everyone hopes for in their draft is they got Quinn Hughes and Elias Pettersson in back-to-back drafts, and they jump right to what we'll introduce in a minute, which is stage 4, which is this. Oh, like you're underrating this team. Like this team's ready. Like it's time. It's time, because number one, people are so sick of it not being time. And number two, because there's something legit happening here. Like there's momentum. So they go from that. And then they make that Myers signing just to be sure, just because they really don't want to stay stuck in purgatory if they can avoid it. And what it actually does is it throws them back into stage three. It throws them backward, because you lose Jacob Markstrom, you lose Tyler Toffoli, and some of these are just GM decisions. They probably could have signed at least one of these guys, but they don't sign any of them. And part of it is because they have this giant Tyler Myers contract on the books. And if you have that flexibility, maybe you keep Jacob Markstrom, who, by the way, looks outstanding in Calgary. Maybe you keep Tyler Toffoli, who I think has 8 goals just against the Canucks this year.
Yeah.
In like 4 games.
Yeah. He's absolutely killing it. I mean,
killing them.
And then Troy Stetcher,
maybe you get
right?
To keep one of these guys. And you let Troy Stetcher walk.
They
right?
didn't qualify him.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. You let him walk. You know, all these things that you do because you tried to go a little too quick. You tried to solidify yourself in stage 4 a little too quick, and oh no, now you're back in stage 3.
Yeah.
So, you know, let's just talk about stage 4 now. Stage 4, which the Red Wings aren't at yet, but I'm trying to think of a good team who's just getting there right now.
Where you're trying to basically say, you know, so stage 4, as you're thinking about it, is like, okay, this team is definitely a playoff contender. Like, yeah. It's a team that's found a way to dig out of their rebuild and is – now a team that you're discussing in the context of, okay, I think they can start contending for a playoff spot. You know, it's tough. Arizona was maybe the team I was thinking of.
How about
last
the Rangers?
Year. The Rangers are a team where it's interesting because you could make the argument that they were more of a stage 3 team in the sense that they may have jumped too early. So you go back to last season, right? They win the second overall pick. They draft Kaapo Kakko. Then they go out and they sign Artemi Panarin for 7 years, Jacob Trouba for 7 years. They give Chris Kreider 7 years. You know, they're throwing money in every which direction. They buy out Kevin Shattenkirk. You know, they do all these different things. And where did they end up? Well, they ended up winning first overall in the lottery with Alexis Lafreniere. But now I think the Rangers are a team maybe in the next year or two, you're going to start seeing them in that phase 4, because now I think by virtue of winning back-to-back lotteries, they are going to be a team that's, you know, there maybe Colorado last season or the year before would have been good. A good example of this. Carolina, yeah, maybe
this is you're actually a playoff team. Like you're not a pretender. Like you're like, okay, okay, now we're getting out here and this is good. So I would agree. The Rangers, they didn't even make the actual playoff. They made the bubble, but the Canes swept them.
Right.
And it doesn't look like they're going to make the playoffs this year. So that's fair. They're not there yet. But I agree. They could get there soon. But that's a good point by you.
Yeah, I think the Avs and the Canes in the last maybe three or four years are the teams that maybe best embody this. The
Canes are beyond it now.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Canes are,
now yeah, you're talking about the Canes and Avs as being the Stanley Cup contenders in this stage 5, although their fans will not believe that, which is the whole point of stage 5. But in that stage 4, I think if you look at maybe the 18-19 Canes, that team didn't have – huge expectations. I think a lot of people expected him to sneak into the playoffs as a 7 or 8 seed, not be the a conference finalist.
Yeah.
And same thing with Colorado.
Philly's a good 4 team.
Philly's another good 4 team. You know, when they've added in these pieces with Nolan Patrick, Travis Konechny, you know, and so on and so forth, you know, Joel Farabee, Carter Hart, they've started to really move into this. Yeah. This team's definitely a playoff contender. I don't think anyone's walking out and saying Philly's a cup favorite. But this is a team that's definitely a playoff contender and will be for the next, you know, couple of years. And they've done a good job, you know, coming back from the Giroux, you know, Voracek phase and smoothly entering this Travis Konechny, Joel Farabee, you know, phase with those guys, you know, Ivan Provorov, Shane Gostisbehere, you know, Carter Hart. They've done a better job smoothing that transition over.
Yeah. Okay. I like that. All right. So then we already teased it. Stage 5. This is the completion. This is why you did the rebuild. It's so that, you know, you get to this place and your team is finally actually really, really good. It's a contender. You don't know if they're going to win, but it's a top 6 to 8 team in the league. Maybe even better than that. Maybe it's a top 5 team. But let's say 6 to 8 right now. And they're so good, and you've been through this harrowing Stockholm Syndrome experience that now you yourself don't even want to believe it. You don't want to let yourself think that it's actually a cup contender. And so now you're telling people that they're overrating this team, because you've seen them disappoint you for already 6 to 8 years, likely by this point in the rebuild stage.
Yeah. My favorite example of this is Dom Lucision having to defend the Maple Leafs as being the best team in the North, or right, arguably the best team, and being a cup contender. Like, he has to defend the Leafs as three. When you look at them, they're, you know, aside from their collapse against Ottawa the other night, they're a very good hockey team. In fact, they've just happened to run into Boston the last couple of years, and then Columbus, you know, but they're a team that's a cup contender this year by virtue of how the divisions are aligned. And Dom has to defend it. Yeah.
Most years they're a cup contender. Yeah. Just they happen to play in division with Boston and Tampa.
Yeah. And so Dom has to defend that decision to put him there. I think Colorado's another team that belongs there. Carolina's a team that belongs there, where it's fans. I mean, Colorado's the odds on favorite to win the Stanley Cup. And right, I still think you'll have a lot of their fans just not truly buy it, not truly believe in it, because you went through hell to get here. Colorado was one of the, you know, 16-17 Colorado, one of the worst teams the last 20 years. So
yes,
that's how quickly you can get back here, but you have to have patience.
Yes. Okay. So the logical question that everyone listening is going to want to know is, number one, are we sure the Red Wings are pivoting into stage three? To which my answer would be no. It's very possible they're still in stage two and they haven't turned that page into stage three yet. But I would say from a fan comment standpoint, based on what I'm receiving, certainly seems like a fan base that's more frustrated by not eking out games than one that is, you know, just convinced that this thing is never going to end. Personally, that's my read on the fan base.
Yeah, I would have the same read. I mean, I have so many people frustrated with, you know, tactics, coaching, players, things along those lines, because they're not getting the same results that they want to see because the team is playing so well recently. So, you know, fingers crossed that if this is what gets the team into stage three, then I think the Wings are in a really good position where, you know, potentially they still draft high this year. You have Moritz Seider, Lucas Raymond, Jonathan Berggren all coming in. You know, potentially the development of Theodore Niederbach is good. And they have so much cap flexibility. They are really in position to do what Colorado and Carolina did and go quickly from stage three to stage five. And that's the challenge, because not every team is going to make it to stage five. Not every team's even going to make it to stage four. A lot of teams shoot themselves in the foot. So that's where it's important for Yzerman and his staff to continue to be patient, because they're set up really well to accelerate through four and five, you know, if they're truly in three right now.
If they are truly in three, which again, I'm not 100% positive that they are, I could easily see this season going off the rails still. And then you're just going to look at this as kind of a blip on the broader kind of arc of 2018 through 2021. And then, you know, that's a long but not unusually long stay in the pit of misery, so to speak. But if this is stage three, then what I will say is, you're also probably looking at next year in that same phase of a, why is this not getting better yet? Come on. Maybe if there's, you know, any major additions or changes or whatever, maybe that's enough to kind of get people to, you know, feel like something's different and it's not just the same old, same old. Maybe that is something that kind of comes into play as an outside factor. But I think they're still going to be a bottom five, bottom three team next season too. Now, they're going to have a lot of turnover. They're going to have a lot of contracts expiring. I believe Nielsen has one more year, but that's a contract that could be bought out by that point. Like, 1 year, you're not too worried about a buyout. Danny DeKeyser, similar kind of situation. He's going to have one more year, but if he's really not healthy, which right now appears to be the case. I mean, he could be in the lineup. He's available to play, but he's not at 100%. And the Red Wings are at the point with him where they waived him. And right now he's on the taxi squad. And that is because they want the roster flexibility over just having him, you know, on the active roster. And it's not a massive deal. Like, I don't think this is like a seismic shift or anything for the Red Wings. Like, you very likely to still see Danny DeKeyser this year. They can call him up any day, as long as they call him up before a certain time. It might be 5 p.m. from the taxi squad, and he can play, and that's no problem. But it does tell you that they're not close. He's not close enough to being in the lineup over Christian Juice or Mark Stahl right now, that they, you know, are having him on the active roster right now. And so, anyways, that was rambling. Darren Helm's contract's up. Valtteri Filppula's contract's up. Patrick Nemeth's contract's up. John Merrill's contract's up. I think that's one that I would renew if I were the Red Wings. Christian Juice is going to be an RFA. You can go either way on that. He had a great goal last night. Who other four? Luke Glendening's up. I would renew him. I know you wouldn't, at a certain number at least. But you get the point. Like, they're going to have a lot of flexibility. They could bring in some guys, and maybe it's a little less painful next year, but everyone knows about the 2022 draft class by this point too. And I think Red Wings fans are going to be attuned to that as much as any fan base in the league. They want Shane Wright, or they want Brad Lambert, or whatever. I don't know if they know about Rucker McGroarty yet. He's the big American guy in that draft, and he's got some really impressive numbers so far at the NTDP. That's a draft you really want to pick in the top three or four. And the Red Wings, I don't think, are going to be necessarily out of that position to do so in a year.
Yeah, I completely agree. And if they play their cards right, you know, next season you bring over Lucas Raymond, Jonathan Berger, and Moritz Seider. Seider probably in the NHL. The other two, you know, likely AHL, although they may sneak some NHL time in depending on how they do in Grand Rapids. You know, you get through the season, potentially you luck out. You have a nice, you know, you end up picking in the top three and you land one of those guys. That's your chance. That's your moment, right? If you're likely picking top five this season, you're picking top three that season, and then you can walk into the 2022 free agency. And at that point, you can think about doing something similar to what Carolina did. You know, Carolina goes, they land Andrei Svechnikov with a second overall pick.
At that trade point, for Dougie.
Right. They go and they trade for Dougie Hamilton. They go and sign Calvin DeHaan. You know, they make the moves necessary to bolster them. I mean, if you're Detroit, Alexander Barkov's a free agent. Philip Forsberg is a free agent. Like, are these guys
that Nashville might be entering a rebuild and, right, and might not be. Yeah.
And so are those guys you go out and you drop money on in that season. All of a sudden now you're like, okay, this is a playoff contender, right? And that's the next step. That's stage four. And so I think there's a lot of possibility that you could see the Wings moving into that stage four as soon as the 2022-2023 season. And the nice thing is the Wings should have that fallback plan where if things don't go in their direction, the 2023 draft still has great guys in there. I mean, Michkov is an outstanding player. He's arguably in the conversation with Shane Wright as the best guy, you know, Rucker McGroarty and those guys as the best prospect in the next 3 years. So you have that fallback where you keep yourself in that kind of stage three. But the important thing is don't force your way out of these stages, because I do think you have to make sure you do things at the right time, and just trying to accelerate it is what's going to kick you. It's going to hurt you in the long run.
Thanks for being willing to do that big elaboration on that. That's how my brain works entirely. I love to think in kind of phases like that and in logical like organizations of how these things work. And when I read that tweet, it set off all these light bulbs in my head about how the NHL world works. And I was immediately thinking of, you know, a team or two for each single phase that you mentioned. I mean, Nashville right now seems to be crossing that bridge from phase one to phase two and realizing, oh God, there is no chance that this roster is currently assembled is going to get it done. Time to try something new. And I think Pittsburgh is not quite there yet, but they might be within a year or two. I keep thinking Boston's about to be there, and then they're just not, and maybe they're just the exception to the rule, but the Red Wings were kind of the exception to the rule for a long time too. And so, you know, it comes for everyone. And I just love that this way of organizing it that you came up with.
Yeah. I think it's just a fun way to think about it. And honestly, for everyone who's watched this team for the last 10 years, it should resonate pretty well if you think about it.
Yeah.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
All right, let's do a couple mailbag questions and then we'll get out of here. How's that sound?
Works for me.
All right. Phil Roberto asks, this is such a good question. He says, we often hear about 200-foot players. How come some players who are good workers are complimented as 200-foot players when they're limited offensively? And so I think what he's getting at here is, if they're 200-foot players, like, why aren't they offensive too? Like, you're only talking about the defensive half of the ice. I've got a theory about this, but I want to hear your answer first.
I have honestly no idea why that is the case. I mean, that's the thing. That's literally something I think I've said for 5 or 6 years, is like, you can't call them 200-foot players if they don't score, right? So Phil, I would love to know the answer to your question here, because I certainly have no clue why that's the case.
I think I have your answer, so that maybe that'll clarify for you as a user of this phrase and a user of this phrase on players who I think meet Phil's criteria here. So I would say, and this is a semantics thing, maybe this is just some writer bullshit and I deserve to be punched in the face for it, but I would say that what you're talking about is a two-way player. That's a player who contributes at both ends offensively and defensively. I think of it as a 200-foot player as someone who plays in all parts of the ice. Like, not necessarily someone who scores, but someone who's going to play behind the goal line and winning forechecks, and someone who's going to be all the way back down behind the other goal line on retrievals, on, you know, puck support on defense. So that's how I think of it. I think of it as they play the whole length of the ice and they're doing things over the whole length of the ice that'll help you win, not necessarily scoring. Whereas I think a two-way player is someone like Dylan Larkin, who scores goals, does things for you on offense, but also is impactful on defense. And I know that that's kind of splitting hairs a little bit, but I do think there's a difference in terms of just 200 foot as they do things over the full ice, goal line to goal line, versus two way, which is they impact both parts of the game.
See, I would normally agree with you, but then I run into the scenario where just about every center is a 200-foot player. Because in just about every defensive scheme, they're the ones responsible going goal line to goal line.
Yeah.
So Robbie Fabry is a 200-foot player.
You're making a good point. But, you know, you're making a good point. I think my counter would be, like, and doing it well. Like, you know, like, I think that, you know, Luke Glendening doesn't score a lot of goals, but he does it well in the offensive zone behind the goal line, like in terms of that, those hard areas of the ice where it's, you're behind the net or you're right at the crease or you're on the cycle. Like, these are things that he does relatively well. He's a good retrieval guy. He's a good forechecker. He's going to battle well, and he's going to do it at both ends. Like, he does it, you know what I mean? Like, but I get it. Like, I do get what you're saying in terms of, like, you're right. There are centers and plenty of them, frankly, that I wouldn't say are 200-foot centers in terms of, I don't think their defensive zone impact or their play in their own, you know, slot and lower end are all that exemplary. So this is a very valid point by Phil. I'm not trying to dismiss it. I'm just trying to explain why I think it happens.
So maybe building off of this, maybe the best definition we can come up with is players who are good at both forechecking and backchecking.
That's basically, yes, that's basically my definition.
All right. Yeah. So then I can buy that, because I don't know that I would call Fabry strong at necessarily, like, I don't think of him as the picture.
And like
of
Adam Ernie, right? He's one of the players that Phil, you know, he listed a few players who he is curious about with this. And Adam Ernie, I think, is a perfect definition. Like, even though he's not a center, like you can kind of count on him to be physical, kind of right down at the lower, you know, lower third of the circle in the D zone and make a big hit. But he's also going to be hard on the fourth. Like that's kind of how I would explain it. And I could very well be wrong in doing that, but I think that's like the intuitive explanation from me.
I could buy a definition that's based on forechecking and backchecking, but then what my view would be is if that's how the definition is set up, then that's not as valuable as how I view a 200-foot player in my head, which is the guy who contributes by scoring and preventing goals on both ends of the ice, which is how I tend to think of it.
And I tend to think of it in like a 200-foot game. Like how is their 200-foot game? Like, can you count on them in every area of the ice? Like, there's players that you wouldn't say like you want in every situation. You don't want them in the corners in the offensive zone, even though they're a great offensive player. Like, you kind of want them at on the slot or at the top of the circle or whatever. You know what I mean? So, like, even from that sense, like, you're exactly right. If you call someone a 200-foot player, there is an implication that that's like, and they're good at all 200 feet. And, you know, that doesn't have to just mean length of the ice. Like, you know, maybe, you know, it's a shorthand phrase and it's going to get misused. So I think that's probably a big part of this is just, you know, you're looking for a quick shorthand descriptor of a player. And if the main thing they do well is forecheck, backcheck, you're right. They're 200. They have good 200 foot game. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I think people have co-opted the phrase for to mean a lot of different things. And so it means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. Which can make it tough to really assess how valuable being labeled a 200-foot player really is.
Yeah. I mean, if the argument here is I should do it less on players who aren't offensively, productive, I'm open to that. Like that's it's and I'm probably
I think
not
he asked that question specifically to get you to stop using the phrase.
To just shut me up. Phil said, Max, you don't know what you're doing. But I think it's a great question. It's such a good talking point. Yeah. All right. What else we got here? Brian says, when is Yzerman going to make his first true hockey trade? Not a cap dump or for futures or a flyer on a reclamation project. He cites Fabbri and Perlini. Although I think you can make a case that Fabbri for De La Rose was somewhat of a hockey trade. But nonetheless, when do you think Yzerman makes his first hockey trade if it's not that Fabbri deal? And what do you think? What kind of deal would you like to see?
So I think there's two ways this goes, and we can tie this back to our phased conversation.
Yeah.
So number one, this team is not actually in phase three.
Yes.
We get through the season. We quickly see that this team is actually a phase two team. In that case, the first trade that I think is made is him dealing Anthony Mantha for somebody. And so you're starting to think about your roster. Yes, you just signed Mantha for, you know, 4 years at a good cap hit. But from an age standpoint, he is going to start to age himself out of being in your kind of core as you move forward. And again, in this hypothetical, the Wings regress. They don't continue to play as well as they've been playing. Let's say they don't. They somehow end up with the sixth overall pick as they're cursed to have in a relatively weak draft. In that situation, I think the earliest I could see him making a legit talent for talent trade would be dealing Anthony Mantha for potentially somebody younger, a younger prospect that's, quite high, kind of a similar move to what Minnesota did with Jason Zucker for a first plus Callan Addison, that kind of talent plus pick situation. Beyond that, if we then take the scenario where Detroit's in phase three, then I don't think you see this deal until Detroit's really ready to go to phase four, which may not be like until 2022, like we just talked about.
Okay, I can dig that. I have no idea. Hockey trades also just aren't that common in the NHL, even among good teams. Like Carolina's Dougie Hamilton deal, I think, is a pretty good example of it. They ship out Hanifin and Lindholm, who I like both of those guys. And they get back Dougie, who's the best player in the deal. But I really would love Elias Lindholm on my team. And I'm perfectly happy with Noah Hanifin on my second pair too, frankly. I think Calgary is pretty happy with that. But Carolina also gets a guy who was on my NHL All-Star ballot last year, I believe, in Dougie Hamilton. And that's a top six defenseman in the league. So, you know, I think that's a great example of a hockey trade. And it comes at basically the exact moment you talked about them shifting phases. And so I think that's a pretty relevant one. Wyman856 says, who are the Red Wings prospects most exceeding your expectations and who are most falling short of them?
The ones this year who are really exceeding expectations, I think, are Sider and Berger. And I think that's The pretty obvious answer, both of those guys have taken a huge step forward. Bergeron in particular, we just needed to see what he looked like when really healthy and playing his game. And you're absolutely seeing that this year. You know, guys that have taken a step back. I think, you know, one for me is Philip Larsen. I think you and I talked about this on the last episode or maybe episode before that. You know, he really started to take the step back last year, but now again, this season, really struggling in a lower level league. He's got to find his game here soon. Cause I think that's a, you know, that's going to be a huge problem for him. And then, you know, a more recent example is Cross Hannes, Red Wings third round pick this past year, really struggled. I mean, he's bouncing all around between the WHL, USHL, has not looked good. Numbers don't look good. Didn't really take, you know, he was a guy billed as a little bit of a playmaker to a certain extent, good passer, good setup man. Haven't really seen it. Yeah. Highly skilled. Haven't seen any of that. And so that'll be a kind of frustrating miss if he doesn't pan out for the Wings, given that, you know, he's a third round pick there and you want those guys.
Second round pick.
Sorry. Yeah. Second round pick. Yeah. So you really don't want to be missing on those ones there.
Yeah. You know, Bergeron is a guy who, you know, I've tried to slow the hype train for people a little bit just to not let expectations get out of hand, but he is definitely my answer. Like, he is, you know, Seider, he's having an unbelievable year, and I don't think anyone could have expected it quite like this, but he was also a stud. Like, you knew it from what he did in the AHL last year. You had a pretty good feeling he was going to go over to the SHL and play really, really well. He's gone a step beyond that. Like, he's one of the, you know, best performing prospects outside the NHL right now. I don't think that's unreasonable to say. But Bergeron is a totally different case where he's coming off two different years of major injuries. And I was getting to the point where it was like, ooh, I don't know if, like, you know, is he going to be able to stay healthy enough? Is he going to be able to put this all together? And he is turning in just a gem of a season. You know, he's at a point per game, still have some questions about what is going to translate and what that will mean for his role. But, you know, you put up a point per game at age 20 in the SHL, and I've got a really hard time saying you're not going to make it and that you're not going to make a difference when you do. And now, I still don't think it's like a top line difference, personally, just because, you know, he still doesn't have the shooting threat to I think be that kind of all around danger that you need. And he's going to run into some problems as he tries to get to the middle of the ice, I think, as he comes to North America. But he's a really legit prospect, and he deserves all the credit in the world for the season he's put together. It's been outstanding.
Yeah, I think if you're looking to bill him for a guy I really like to compare him to is almost Yuri Hudler to a certain extent for the Red Wings for a really long time. On those Red Wings Cup teams, Hudler was kind of a second line, third line forward that would also play on the power play. And I think that's the role that you're going to see from Jonathan Bergeron is, you know, on a good team, he can be that second line, third line depth scorer that is kind of a highly skilled. Hudler didn't really have a great shot. He had a good one. He just didn't shoot it all that often. So I think his shot's maybe a little better than Berggren's, but same kind of playmaking mentality and will give you really good support on a good team.
And Hudler had the one huge year in Calgary where he was like a point per game player just about. But most of the time he's in that, you know, 30 to low 50s range. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable expectation in terms of points for Bergeron. Like, once he comes over here, yeah, like, don't expect your like 60 point first line player. But, you know, year to year with some fluctuation, I think you're going to see somewhere between 30 and 50 points would be my guess.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Okay. And 50 might be high. I don't know. But, you know, I think it's still fair with what he's done in the SHL to give him a little bit of benefit of the doubt in terms of numbers.
Yeah, especially if you get power play time. So
on the downside, my thing cut out when you said your first one, but were you talking about Svechnikov or Chalowski there?
No, actually, the first one I said was Philip Larsen.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely fair. But, you know, I think it's fair that to say that. Well, Chalowski, and we didn't really get to see a lot, and Svechnikov was injured, but I do think those are two stock down prospects in the sense, just because the Red Wings haven't really given him a look, and you can argue that that's as much on the Red Wings as it is on either player. I might argue that, but you know, the fact that it's happening this way does tell me that you're less and less like, oh, as we're recording, Svechnikov got bumped up to the taxi squad. I don't know if you've seen that yet.
Oh, okay.
He got called up to taxi squad. I don't know what that means necessarily. Like, you know, they sent Smith down, and I assume that's just because they want to get him playing. So why would they call Svechnikov up? You know, unless he's going to play, but you know, I don't see, we will see. Like that's the likeliest thing in the world. So I'm very interested in that. And if he does play, maybe this comment by me changes, but I think Svechnikov and Shalovsky for a couple of former first round picks, it's trending in the wrong direction, not even necessarily because of their play, but just because it hasn't broken through. And I don't think that's all on them. I think it's, you know, certainly the Red Wings bear some blame for that too. But it's the reality of the situation.
Yeah. Yeah. I completely agree.
All right. Let's find a good one to close on. Doug Beckman asks, do you expect Steve Yzerman to be an aggressive seller at the deadline? And if yes, who would the likeliest names to be moved be?
Yeah, that's tough because, I mean, you look at the roster and I mean, there are guys you certainly could sell. I mean, we talked about Bobby Ryan being a guy before the season that if he was like, yeah, let me go chase my ring, you know, Yzerman could certainly move him in that respect. I don't know that Bobby Ryan nets you a big offer, really. You know, and outside of that, I mean, certainly you could look to move Mark Stahl. He's played reasonably for the Wings, and maybe some team is interested in taking him on if the Wings retain some salary. But other than that, I mean, unless you're prepared to move Jonathan Bernier, who's going into expiration, I don't really see a lot of guys that you're going to deal at the deadline unless you're going to like make a huge move and, you know, move an Anthony Mantha or something like that.
Two that stand out to me, number one, Bernier, because I think, you know, the need for goaltending this year has been underlined and there's enough good teams out there who I think could be like, you know, maybe not cup contenders, but like could make a little bit of a run if they had better goaltending. I think Edmonton falls in that category. I'm not yet sold on Vanacek in Washington, although he has played pretty well. Pittsburgh would fall into that category for me, especially if they're of the mind that they really want to keep, you know, squeezing every last drop out of this orange. I don't necessarily know if it's in the Red Wings' best interest to trade Jonathan Bernier, especially if you're not going to get something like, you know, I would want at least a second round pick if I was the Red Wings for him. But, you know, I think there'll be enough goaltending demand that he should have a market. I think the same of Bobby Ryan. Maybe a little less like in terms of positional, like, you know, most teams have forwards, but most teams are also always looking for a little extra scoring at the deadline. And he doesn't make a whole lot of money. Teams aren't going to have big cap problems acquiring him. And he's proven and he's an unreal locker room guy. And so he's not the kind of guy that you're going to have any worries adding. But I also think the Red Wings with Bobby Ryan are kind of in a position where if they keep him, he's good for them for that same reason. Like he's a good guy you want to have around. And if you're not getting a great offer, what's the point? And maybe Bobby Ryan's feelings impact that too. Like maybe if he wants to go chase a cup contender, that weighs into things, or if he really, you know, would rather kind of stay with this group and try to see it through a little bit or potentially even extend. I think that'd be a key part. If the Red Wings aren't going to trade him, they should be saying, well, you want to do another year. So that would make some sense for me. I'm trying to think if there's anybody I'm really missing.
It's tough. I mean, you look at the roster. I just don't see guys that...
Has Mark Stahl rehabbed his game enough to get into this conversation? I mean, he's played pretty well over the last few weeks.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's a guy that, again, if you're willing to retain, you could probably find somebody who will take him.
Yeah. The cap number is a big concern there. You're right. And obviously that's why the Red Wings, you know, got a second round pick to take him. I mean, if you ate half of it, that's 2.9-ish. Still pretty high, but he's a veteran defenseman. He's got playoff experience. I mean, it wouldn't stun me. Luke Glendening. Did you say Luke Glendening?
I didn't say Glendening. I mean, he's a guy that, you know, again, if someone's willing to pay for him.
He's the best faceoff man in the NHL so far this year. I think, I don't know if people have heard that stat yet.
I don't think anyone has heard that as we've been watching the Fox Sports Detroit broadcast.
I mean, it's legit. It's a legit question. I mean, he's an assistant captain on the team. I think I would re-sign him if it were me. And so for that reason, I think I would hold a pretty firm line on Luke Glendening, but I'm sure teams will call. Why wouldn't you call?
Yeah. I mean, let him call and I would trade him for anything that's a third round pick or better. So
I think I'd hold out for a second, but you know, I think the line for me goes at fourth, like it's seconds and thirds. You got my attention. Fourth and beyond, you know, unless it's a guy who I've got no time for. I don't know. But I know that's a problematic opinion in terms of what the numbers say about the value of a third versus a fourth. But
yeah, I mean, there's functionally no difference.
It's my bird brain talking.
It's all good.
You know what, though? Depending on how this next draft shakes out, and we'll wrap right after this, I promise. If they end up moving it back like a meaningful amount, I really want as many second and third round picks as possible if I'm a GM. You're going to get so much extra sample. And all these guys who you look at, and in most years, like, you're like, oh, shoot, Arthur Kaliev should have gone first round. Oh, shoot, Nils Höglander should have gone first round. And you can tell, like, you know, a year or sometimes less later, you might actually get that benefit beforehand. And if you're a team like the Red Wings, that's going to have one of the first two or three picks of the second round, that's a big coup. And if you're a team like the Red Wings, that's going to have three or potentially more if they pick up another one, picks in the second and third round, or four, I think right now, in the second and third rounds for this next draft, five. I want as many of those as possible, because you're going to get some clarity and you're going to snap up a guy who might have gone in the fourth round, who now looks like he should be a borderline, you know, first or second rounder.
Yeah, I think either direction.
Maybe not fourth, but second. Yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I mean, either way, I think you want him. Whether it's you're going to do a draft where nobody's seen anybody, you want as many shots at the dart.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Or if you are going to do a draft where you get extra time to see people, then yeah, you still want as many shots at the dartboard.
Absolutely. I agree completely. All right. With that, we will close. I know we ran long today, but I really wanted to do that whole rebuild phases thing. And I had a blast. I hope you guys enjoyed it as much as I did. And if not, I'm sure you'll tell me.